What were you asking me?
I'm sort of quite. I'm going to be quite quiet. Is that okay? Just usually I've,
volume wise.
Yeah, I feel like volume wise actually also affects my emotion wise.
Right.
So if I start talking low, I deliver low energy.
Do you get low?
Yeah.
What if we both talk like this all the way through?
But I'm not talking like that. You're just...
This is what it sounds like you're talking like to me. Low. As though you're whispering in the ear of a loved one after coitus.
Yeah, but you're like going, of a loved one. I'm not putting a stupid cadence on my words. I'm just
doing
talking
a podcast like Bob Dylan.
I'm talking in hushed tones because... I am the only parent here, and my children are asleep, and I have a 3.5-year-old who likes to wake up sometimes. Hello, and welcome to the Movies You Forgot podcast. With me, your host, Adam Richmond. This is the show in which we talk about movies we forgot we'd even seen in the first place. Me and my best pal of all time. He's an old licky bucket boy, but I don't hold it against him. He can't seem to hold on to just anything, hence the name the Leaky Bucket Boy. He forgets things. If you're joining us, that's why he's got the nickname. And his name is Mr. Joe Devine.
Hello there, all right?
Yeah, you're going low as well.
I'm matching your energy, because if I were to do the podcast like this, it would be weird if it went back and forth between me saying, I like the film, and you going, I like the film.
Why is it that whispering is kind of equated to sex?
Yeah, it's not whispering. It's soft and proximity, because the thing is, not only are you speaking quieter, you're speaking closer to the microphone because you are psychologically aware that your volume is lower than normal. So what you've done is you've leaned in and you're talking a bit like this. It's the proximity. The listener will be able to feel your breath on their ear, you know, in a nice way, I'm hoping. For others, they might not like it, but there's nothing you can do about it now. Let's just breathe in their ears. It's fine.
Yeah, and yeah, maybe it's a suitable episode to be going quiet, because the film that we are doing on today's show is all about listening and silence
and watching
and whispering
and rubbing.
We are, of course, today covering the 2006. Flick, Das Leben der Anderen.
Yes.
The Lives of Others.
Das Leben der Anderen.
That's a German film, directed by Florian Henkel von Donnersmarck. Here's the letterboxed. Before the fall of the Berlin Wall, East Germany's secret police listened to your secrets. In 1984, East Berlin, an agent of the secret police, the Stasi, it doesn't say that here, they're called the Stasi, they're known as the Stasi. I'll go back now. In 1984, East Berlin, an agent of the secret police conducting surveillance on a writer and his lover finds himself becoming increasingly absorbed by their lives.
Absorbed is the key word there, because I couldn't decide how to describe that relationship, because it's not quite obsessed, but it's certainly not unmoved, is it? Absorbed, very interesting.
I think absorbed is a bit too soft, because I'm getting ahead of myself, but he clearly comes to care about them and wants to protect them.
Entwined.
Entwined again doesn't suggest agency on his part. This man who listens to the lives of others, he dips in.
Right, yeah, he's a dipper.
He's a dipper. This is 137 mins. Ooh, that's not a runtime I tend to like. But I didn't feel it too much this time.
Ooh. I think it earns it, personally. I don't often intervene in the runtime section of the podcast, but I don't feel a damned thing during the runtime of this one.
I think it earns it too. Before I list the cast, does it earn the 4 or 5 endings, the you know, Return of the King style endings that it has? Is this getting ahead of myself?
It is getting ahead of yourself. I'd love to talk about that. And I think you'll approve of this, but But I think there's we can definitely do this podcast without giving away what the endings are and still talk about them. So I think we should talk about that, but not now. You do the cast first. And if you want, I can help you with names because I'm very good with German names.
Well, yeah, every time I get it wrong, you come in with your oity-toity... Oity-toity? That doesn't make any sense. The proper version. Also, yeah. I need to get my Lives of Others screenplay, which is on my bookshelf. Ooh. And has been in my bag because I'm going to read something from that.
Okay, get it. Ulrich Murcher.
Let's just do the key ones. Yeah. So, it stars Martina Gedeck. Mm-hmm. I'm going to dig into this because I think we'll return to these character names. She plays a famed German, East German actress called Christa Maria.
Yeah.
Ulrich Moo.
I think there you would say Ulrich Murcher. Like, so when you see the U with the umlaut above it, when you spell it in English instead of in German, that would be a U-E or an So it's more of an than a oo, right? So it'd be like Murcher.
He plays Gerd Wiesler.
Yeah, who I'd like to call him Hagever if we can for this because it's HGW, and that's what he becomes known as at various points in the film, Hagever.
Okay, so he plays the Stasi agent. I'd like to just call him the Stasi agent.
Okay, I'll call him Hagever, you call him the Stasi agent. Or Wiesler.
Gerd Wiesler. Sadly, who died soon after the making of this film. Sebastian Koch.
Koch. You could say Koch. That's fine. Koch.
He's so handsome, this guy. He plays George, or Gorg. Georg?
George. I think you can say George, it's fine.
Okay. George Draiman. He plays the writer the Stasi agent is observing.
I would say we could introduce the others as we go, because those are the three key characters, and there's already a lot of names to deal with.
Yeah. It's Christa Maria, Gerd Wiesler, a.k.a. the Stasi agent, AJA... Yeah. Hagever, and George.
Yeah, writer, actually, girlfriend, Stasi.
I think let's get a little bit of context, right? Should we talk about just context of it of the film, because it's quite important?
I think it's very important, and we're probably going to talk about it more.
And I think when I saw it in 2006, I wasn't really super familiar with the nuts and bolts of that of the idea of the Berlin Wall, East Berlin, West Berlin. I was always a bit, I think I was just a bit thick about it. Like, even if I'd read a John le Carré, and it maybe pops up in, I think it's a plot point in The Living Daylights.
Right.
The idea of defectors, and it's obviously a big thing. You got the four different areas back. If you look at The Third Man, that like is super confusing to me, and this is a simplified version. It's just east and west, and you're like, "Sorry, hang on a sec. What? So there's Russia and there's communism. What's Germany got to do with this?"
Sure.
So it took me some time to really bother to kind of get to know what's going on here, and I'm there now.
You're there now. Would you like me to do a quick précis?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I couldn't do it. Because even though I know, I definitely couldn't do it.
Okay. It's the Second World War, Adam. Yeah? Remember Hitler? He was the German leader. I won't go into this much detail. The point is, the Soviets were approaching Berlin at the same time as the Allied forces of the West were. France, Germany, the USA, right? England and the USA. And after the Second World War had finished, after Hitler had committed suicide, there were various different pacts and treaties in order to discuss and decide how to essentially divide up the temporary or not governance of Germany, and specifically Berlin. Now, what's interesting about Berlin is it's in the northeast of the country. And what the Soviets and the Western Allies did was decide to just split Germany in half. The Western Allies would take over temporary governance and look after the west of Germany and help, revive a new German government, although that's a much more complicated story. And the Soviets would take control of and do the same thing for the east part of Germany. But Berlin, the capital, and it was obviously a key political importance, it still is now, is in the East. So the way that they decided to deal with that was to just split that in half as well and have West Berlin, even though it was in a sea of East Germany and surrounded by Soviet control, it was technically an Allied forces safe haven. And then East Berlin...
Oh, hang on a sec, sorry. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You've said safe haven.
Oh, yeah, you don't like it when I say safe haven, do you? I'm sorry. It was an Allied forces haven in a sea of communist-controlled East Germany, right? And then you have, obviously, East Berlin separated from West Berlin by the wall. This went on from the end of the Second World War until 1989, which is the fall of the Berlin Wall. The Berlin Wall, of course, constructed essentially in the centre of Berlin to prevent people from East Germany, in East Berlin specifically, defecting to West Berlin and leaving. And the reason that they might want to do that, I mean, there are so many numerous reasons that it would be impossible to kind of summarise them.
So then what kind of... what is the political landscape of that country? Like, what's the vibe?
Well, in simple terms, what's happening in East Germany is that the Soviet Union is exporting communism, or they call it socialism, but essentially communism, and building a large bureaucratic social government apparatus in order to enforce that. The Stasi, who some of the main characters from this film are from, is an organization which oversees that effort. It's essentially the secret police and keeps people in line in order to ensure that the system works appropriately. That would be the consideration. So economically, the east of Berlin and East Germany is lagging severely behind the west. The west under... I mean, this is obviously just a description of what happened as opposed to my personal political opinions, but like the West under the capitalism of the Allied forces is booming. It returns from its post-war state of total deprivation to a much more comfortable living environment far, far quicker than East Germany does. And so in Berlin specifically, what you ended up having was a whole group of citizens that just happened to live in the East now living under Soviet communism with complicated and like tricky economic circumstances, watching their friends, neighbours and family members oftentimes in the West enjoying a different sort of life with far less oversight and scrutiny from authorities. So that's why people started to defect. Everyone wanted to leave. That's why eventually they built a wall, and that's why they eventually built the apparatus which became the Stasi. And all of this information about every citizen was collected and stored in the Stasi headquarters. That's essentially what this film is about. It's about one story that happens within this environment, but really the film is a depiction of the type of kind of surveillance operation that would take place in East Germany and the impact that it had on the people that were living there.
John Le Carré wrote the foreword for the screenplay. Here we go. Published by Pushkin Press. In terms of the importance of this and like what the film talks about, I'll leave it to John Le Carré.
Oh yes, please do.
Da 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 da.
Is that how it starts?
Da 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 da.
This is how Sonnet for a Good Man goes. Da 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 da.
Like the Battle for Algiers, it is both a political document and an enduring work of art, collecting together in one convincing story such themes as political obedience, moral courage, the award of power to the weak, and the spiritless void of a police state that suppresses individualism, makes an enemy of humanity, and has nothing to offer on its own account but a descent into paranoia and greyness. Which is, I mean, what a sentence. But yeah. Then I'll just, one other bit, and this is where Le Carré just talks specifically about kind of spycraft and spies. All across the world, intelligence services, despite repeated examples of their incompetence, have proved disproportionately powerful in the making of what passes for foreign policy. And we do well to remember how quickly even our own spies, in choosing the profession of secrecy, become not just its practitioners, but its prisoners, and that by disavowing their natural humanitarian instincts in the name of a supposedly great cause, they too display a dissatisfaction with their own lives that can only only be appeased by reducing the lives of others to the same condition. Mm. So that, for me, kind of covers the film.
That's the end of the show.
You really wanted to do this flick. Yeah. I'm really glad you did, because you've obviously not forgot. You forgot it. I definitely had forgot. I'd forgot it. How can we even begin to discuss this flick?
I don't know, really. I mean, I think, like I said before, we can probably manage this without spoiling anything. Briefly, I'm curious to know, generally speaking, what you remembered about it, given that you only watched it once when it came out in 2006 or whenever, and that was nearly 20 years ago. What were you surprised by or had completely forgotten about when you were watching it again?
I think I'd forgotten everything. I think when I saw it, it was one of those films, so that it was the foreign film of that year. It won the Oscar for best foreign film, did it? Or best for, oh shit, I think it did. And so I think when I saw it, I would have been half-assedly familiar with the context, the historical context, but not really. Uh-huh. And I think I've found it quite handsome and very decent, and like filed it away as like something I'd probably never watch again.
Yeah.
Which I think I think it did it a bit of a disservice, because I think you could come back to that maybe every 10 years. So it's been 20 years. I should have watched it 10 years ago, basically.
Right, yeah.
Having said that, it doesn't look great. You know, it's not a particularly visually impressive film to watch. So I can see how it might have slipped past me in that regard.
I like that about it, though. I think that's kind of, I don't know, but to give the cinematographer and the director the benefit of the doubt, I do wonder if that is purposeful.
I think maybe that's just why it didn't, there's nothing visual to kind of hang on to.
I mean, there are a few shots through peepholes in doors, and there are shot, you know, there is the occasional shot to give the indication of watching from an illicit angle as a scene occurs. But I think the main thing I feel when I'm watching it is that it's very easy, because of the color grading, which is very gray and blue, and because of the very kind of pragmatic approach to filmmaking, it's very easy to absorb a tone from that, the vibe of East Berlin at this time, which is a bit bleak and very boring and behind its time, and it doesn't look like other films, or it, you know, it doesn't look like West Berlin, and it isn't exciting. It's small and subtle, and so I mean maybe that's being too kind to the filmmakers, but I think expressing in some way the tone, what it felt like to be in East Berlin. So I've visited the Stasi headquarters. There's a scene towards the end of this film where George Draiman visits there after the fall of the Berlin Wall, and it's this big grey building, essentially. You wouldn't really know. It doesn't look like any other museum I've ever been to. And it is a museum now. You can go there, you can look around. Most of the exhibits are the sort of spy equipment that they used to use. So there's some very funny, like old-looking, but obviously, you know, ingenious for the time, tiny little cameras and all note-taking equipment. And you can't go into, but you can look at the records room where they keep everything. The cafe in this place, there's no gift shop, but the cafe in this place is, it was an 80-year-old woman sat at a little sort of school table, just with bottles and water on it and tea and coffee and stuff. And you go in and, you know, it's like being in a community center. And there's no music and there's no noise and everyone's whispering. And it's like there's a feeling of oppressiveness just being in there. And this place holds immense importance to the people of Berlin for reasons that, you know, you would discover if you watch the film, and perhaps we can talk about a little bit later. But it looks and feels exactly like the film looks and feels. So I just wonder if maybe some of that is purposeful, you know?
Yeah. There's one bit of really fantastic storytelling that... Oh, the cat's gone. That never repeats. It's it's not workmanlike. It's just really, really solid and well done. At the beginning, you see the Stasi agent, Mir.
Ulrich Mir.
What do you want to call him? A.G.
Hargaver.
Hargaver.
Yeah.
It begins with a interrogation that he's administering, and it's really good because it sets the stakes of what the whole film is about and the world you live in,
and the character as well.
And the character. So it's basically the first introduction of the day. It's the first day for the guy who's being. It's the initial interrogation. It starts, and that you're in the scene, and then the film cuts and jumps out, and he's playing the audio of that interrogation to his students, and then he is explaining what's going on, and then he says, "Let's fast forward," and he fast forwards, and then you jump back, and it's fast forwarded in time.
Yeah,
I love that kind of stuff. I'm like, oh, Sir Christopher Nolan would be all over that kind of storytelling device.
Well, it does so much as well, because we've talked about this before. The opening scene to LA Confidential.
Yes,
it's not the same sort of thing, right?
No, not LA Confidential. It's the
It's the letter one, isn't it?
No, it's the one we talked about. This I'm so glad you brought this up. It's the scene. It's where everything is established in the lecture.
Oh yeah, that's in the Ninth Gate.
That's in the Ninth Gate.
So it's a combination of these two films we've covered before. It's a combination of the lecture scene from the Ninth Gate, but also this opening. This intro scene from LA Confidential, where not only, as you said, do you learn about the world, you learn about what's happening, you learn about what this character does, you learn everything about this character too, because the things that are taking place in this scene essentially are quite distressing. And there's a student who voices some concern about what's happening, and Ulrich Mercher simply adds a little X next to that desk name on his notes, and you wonder what becomes of that student, never going to make it in the Stasi. He's unmoved, he's efficient. You watch him being amazing at what he does, but you don't get any sense that he is particularly politically minded. He just seems like a very efficient Stasi tool, you know, and it's a wonderful entrance for a character.
Well, he's committed to the rule book. He's a Jobsworth.
Yeah.
But beyond that, you know, he's got nothing. Very compelling character, you know, very sad. He's got very soulful little face. You feel really, he's so lonely. He's so sad.
Yeah.
He's aching to find meaning, and he will find meaning.
Yeah. Through a floorboard. I was going to say, that's one of the funny things about the film. I'm sure very intentional. Obviously, generally speaking, I think we like characters that are lonely, isolated, but also, you know, have some kind of special superpower. And in his case, it's that he's this incredible interrogator, this incredible spy. So he has value, but nobody really sees it in his personal life. But what's so interesting about the film is that it's set in a context of what is essentially purports to be an environment of collectivism, where characters are in rooms on their own, listening to each other through walls. You know, it's like they're very isolated, they're very individual in that sense. It's kind of, that's what I like about the reading, that this main character isn't particularly politically motivated, or at the very least that many of the characters in the film, maybe aside from him, if you say for a second that Hargaver, our lead Stasi investigator, is politically motivated and is a believer, nobody else in the film is. They're either using it to their own ends, or they are in some way trying to rebel against it or navigate around it, right? It's that wonderful term, you know where I'm going with this, Adam, don't you? The title of that terrific Adam Curtis documentary, hypernormalization. That word, you know, defined, applied to a Soviet society in the midst of a breakdown, where the description is everyone there knows that what we're all saying about what's happening isn't really happening. But because nobody knows what to do about it, they all just pretend that it is happening, even though they all know it isn't happening. And that's a really lovely description of this film as well. It's almost as though our lead character, Hargaver, the person through whose eyes we see a lot of the film, is just the last person to learn that in East Berlin. Before we move on, though, can I tell you something you just reminded me of?
Yeah.
Yeah, I watched a Czech art film once in the ICA cinema in London. For people who don't know, the ICA is like, it's like an art gallery sort of exhibition place. It's famous, and it's also, it's on the mall. What do you call it, the mall or the mall?
I'd say the mall, because the mall is something that Americans go to.
Sure, but it's like Pall Mall, you know, for Americans listening who play Monopoly. That's basically a weird private seeming road, which is where all the Queen's like red hatted soldiers are, and I don't know, it's just a weird, you know, it's in a very,
it's not weird, that bit's that, there's no red hatted soldiers by the ICA.
They're up and down the Mall all the time, man. That's where they Mall. That's where they march.
that's where they Mall.
That's where they're Malling. Anyway, it's in a very famous location. Point is, it's a weird art cinema gallery.
It's always weird. Why'd you say weird?
It's weird because they have, it's not just like a normal place where you might go and see the sort of slightly alternative film. It's the place where they are dedicated to putting on the most mental shit that is never good. That's what I'm saying. Yeah? Is that fair? Is that not a fair description of the ICA? I love the ICA, but, you know, every time I go there, I watch a film that is not on in any other cinema in the country. Either because it's 50 years old or because it is, you know, so incredibly niche that it would never get a run anywhere else.
Right, yeah, that, it's not mental or weird. It's specifically an art house cinema, like, sure, as it is supposed to be.
I like,
and
to
that's
call,
why I'd never go there.
I like to call it mental and weird.
I have been there a number of times.
Yeah, yeah, we've been there
I
together.
I also like the fact that you're trying to one-up me, having seen a Czech film with... I saw a Czech film once too, and let me tell you all about it.
Well, let me tell you all about it, because it's a more important Czech film than the one that you watched, and it came out earlier, you know. That's the reason I'm telling you. I saw the film Daisies from 1966, which is a Czechoslovakian experimental surrealist comedy art film written and directed by Vera Chytilova, probably. Don't know how to pronounce her name. It is weird and mental. I remember thinking it was quite funny. I did not understand what was happening. I had to Google it afterwards. And the film is mostly two girls dancing topless on a table that's covered in all nice food, when I guess there isn't any food around.
Hey, I saw that. I think I saw that film earlier on today. Yeah, yeah. I don't know whether it was called Daisies.
Right. It was in your house. Was it your children?
Wait, just do the joke without my kids.
Sorry, yeah. Oh, I thought that was the joke you were making. There were two kids, like, topless dancing around on top of a table. That's not weird.
Oh, no. No, I was talking about me watching pornography.
Oh, right. Okay, right. Okay, hold up. I didn't get that at all.
Hang on a sec. Okay, let me read you the joke.
Yeah. Was it on Pornhub.com?
No, wait a sec.
Oh.
Do that. Right. I think I watched that film last night, late last night, when everyone had gone to bed. Yeah.
Oh, yeah?
I don't know how I accessed it.
How did you feel about its ban from the theatres in the Czechoslovak Socialist Republic? Did you feel hard about that? Or
yeah.
What? What did I miss?
I just said, let's talk about Lonely Voyeurs. And No, I'm not talking about me. I'm talking about the film, The right. Lives of Others.
Right, yeah. What have you been looking at?
Well, we're all watchers, aren't we? You know, we watch people.
Yeah.
We look. I certainly saw, I didn't see myself in the lead of this film.
Right.
But I sort of did. You know, he's a sad, lonely man
yep.
who struggles to find human connection. Right. But wait a minute, I did see quite a lot in him. and I really connected with him. To make the protagonist of your film a Stasi guy and you feel for him, it's quite impressive.
It's extremely impressive. And I think it's also very important. You said before, and I hope I'm not jumping here, you said before, does the film perhaps it earns its runtime, does it earn its multiple endings? And what you meant by that was, at the end of the film there are three maybe time jumps, each time it's for a number of years, right? So overall I think you've jumped about a decade by the time the film finishes, from about, you know, I don't know, 15 minutes before the end, when it's where most of the film has been set. And that's kind of a strange thing. I think when you're watching this film, you've been so in embroiled with these characters, with this very specific story, with this very specific time, that it's not expected and it's not necessarily welcome when that happens. You know, you have visions of other films that have done this and it's gone wrong. It is unideal that this happens. And I think I think the film would maybe like longer to resolve those things, because, you know, one of the wonderful things about this film is it's about a character who sits and listens all day, every day to two people who aren't doing that much, right? That so much of the film is quite sparse and subtle and small. So for there to be suddenly a lot of like big, important jumps to the big, important key moments at the end of the film, it does feel strange. But the reason I think they had to do it is because it's extremely important. This is not just a story about these three people whose lives intertwine. This is a representation of something that happened to a whole country of people for a number of decades. And after the fall of the Berlin Wall, after the dissolution of the Soviet Union, something that was really interesting that happened in East Berlin and East Germany was the Stasi headquarters were opened. And the files that had been kept in there on all of the citizens were suddenly available to those citizens when they wanted to go and get them. So I suppose it's probably a little bit less like this now as we move further and further away from when the wall did fall. But certainly for a long time in East Germany, in East Berlin, you could be categorized into one of two groups, depending on whether you requested and looked at the files that were about you or you didn't. And a lot of people did. Obviously, they wanted to know, what was written about me? What did the secret police say about me? What did my friends and neighbors say about me? A lot of people decided that they just didn't want to know, and their files are still there for them if they ever want to, or still there for family. But unfortunately, there's not a lot of catharsis to be found there, because more often than not, what happened was you would go and request your files, you would look at them, and what you would find was that your friends, your family, your neighbors, your colleagues had been either coerced or not into revealing information about you, giving information about you, ratting on you, another way to put it, right? And so there are two things about this film that I think are really important beyond just it being set in that environment and showing people who didn't know about it what that was like, right? The first is that there's a very specific scene that happens. It's not too far after the beginning of the film, and it's when Hargaver is already surveilling Draymond's house. He's got a little junior assistant who's like there half the time when Hargaver's not there, and it's the junior assistant there. He's sitting up in the attic of this house, and he's typing up in his report what he's hearing, and Christina Maria Zeeland, the girlfriend of the writer, she comes home and she tells Draymond, she says that their friend, who is a writer, has been denied a travel visa to go to the West and lecture about his books. And George Draiman's response is a pretty pragmatic one that suits his character and explains why he's, you know, he's still allowed by the state to make plays. He's kind of listed as like a safe listed writer. He says, "What do you expect them to do in their position?" Which is, I think, is an understandable, pragmatic thing to say and a pragmatic way to respond to this situation, what he hears about his friend. The junior assistant of Hargavar, what he types down is, "Draiman approves of the travel ban," which is not what Draiman said. It is a slight misunderstanding of what Draiman said. And I think they go to lengths to show you this is happening. This is not super relevant to the story, but they go to cinematic lengths to show you this. And I think the key reason why is because not everything that you read in those reports is totally accurate, right? Here's a perfect example of something which is essentially harmless, said in a conversation, where when it's been reported by someone who's either lazy or unobservant or misunderstands, it's taken out of context and it means something completely different. And if you read that years later and you were the person who'd had the travel ban, you might then think that your friend was saying he supported your travel ban when that wasn't what was happening. So that's the first thing. I think that's really important because I think that probably would have been easy to forget if you open your file and all your friends and neighbours have said these things about you.
It sounds like you're trying to defend yourself about that thing you said about your wife and that she heard about, like, you WhatsApped me something. Yeah. You sent me a voice note.
That's right.
And I think she found out about it. I think she overheard me then telling that story.
And it was out of context.
To a friend of us. And now it sounds like this is like a partly an appeal to her, you know, like to thaw relations.
What she heard was you saying, the other important thing is a little less nuanced and a little less hidden in the text. It is what you started with, that our protagonist Hargavar is a potentially politically motivated member of the, very effective member of the Stasi. And he's the protagonist for a film made really not that long after the fall of the Berlin Wall. Okay, we're talking less than 20 years after this has all happened. The wall comes down, this film comes out. Now, can you imagine the level of feeling towards people that worked in his position like the one that our protagonist does? Very negative. Okay, I the film is not defending all of the people that worked in the Stasi, far from it, but it is showing a different side to it. It is showing a different side to some of them. There's that wonderful scene towards the end of the members of the secret police. They're all down in the basement. They're steam opening mail, so they're like surveilling everybody's mail. This is where Hargavar's been put after he's, you know, his sort of ruse has been discovered and he's being punished by being, you know, having to go down and work in the basement for 20 years. And they're listening, they hear that the Berlin Wall has fallen, and they simply stand up and leave the room. You know, like, these people, they weren't all ideologues, they weren't all bad people, you know. I think that's the other reason why the film is very important. So that's why I forgive if there is any ineffectiveness about the multiple endings, because they are required in order to show that. And that's more important that is accurate than the film ends perfectly in the way that you might want it to.
We haven't talked at all about... I talked about, like, lonely voyeurs, and we didn't talk about any of them. There's such a history of lonely voyeurs in cinema.
Tell me.
Well, I know how people love lists, but I did a little list. I'll say a list of films, yeah, and then you have a think.
Can we play that good-bad game, or haven't seen it game?
Yeah, maybe. Although, also, there was a lovely, like, letterboxed exchange that I saw on Darren Nolan's... He reviewed Hail Caesar. And
listener Darren Nolan.
Listener Darren Nolan. And then listener Lloyd. They're like, these are listeners, mm-hmm, having little chats on reviews.
And maybe they're friends now.
I mean, I'd hope so.
Yeah.
And they'd both basically nailed the reviews. And I fished for a compliment, which I got. And then I'd said, oh, we're going to do...
Oh, sorry, guys. I'm awfully sorry. It wasn't what I thought. I couldn't... You know, we didn't do such a good job. I don't suppose you liked anything about it, did you? Is there anything you could think to say to a humble, sorry little man who really should be doing better with himself? Nothing good about me, is there? No, no.
Oh, God, you've given me a Russell Brand voice. Yeah, yeah. I don't know why I did that.
Yeah, sorry.
So anyway, I said, oh, we'd... Can you? I'm trying to come up with a list where the protagonist is a bit of a lonely voyeur perv.
Mm.
I've come up with 1 hour photo in the conversation. Lloyd recommended Nightcrawler.
Oh, you put them to work. You put the listeners to work. Yeah, man, damn right. Get to work. Not just sitting, listening to what we're saying, much like Hargaver does. Yeah, you got to intercede. You got to, when Adam tries to leave, you got to catch him in the pub and send him back my way. My true love. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, so Lloyd says Nightcrawler, which we can come back to. Yep. And then Darris says, Lloyd's nailed it, not much to add, Taxi Driver.
Yeah.
A lot of Hitchcock, uh-huh. Vertigo perhaps chiefly. Yeah, so I'd say you've got The Conversation, 1 hour photo, Red Road, did you ever see that one?
No.
Andrew Arnold.
I don't know who that is.
Never mind. But then you've got Blow Up, Blow Out, and then obviously you've got Vertigo and Rear Window.
Right, yeah.
And... yeah, Nightcrawler as well. I think that's a really good shout.
Yeah. Yeah, although it's more decided, isn't it? About what it is. About what's happening. It's a bit more decided. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, no. These are just films where you've got a lonely perv.
Yeah.
They're not like what films are like the lives of others.
Sure. No, I understand. I'm just saying in terms of in the lonely perv canon. You know what I mean? Within that list, I would say that Nightcrawler is very decided about what kind of lonely perv Jake Gyllenhaal is playing.
Yeah, but he's confused, right?
He's just a sociopath. He's not confused at all. Like he's completely clear.
No, he's angry. He screams in the mirror.
Sure. When it's not going to plan.
He thinks this is what he needs to do to be happy. I feel
great
confusion.
Yeah, he's deluded. He's not confused.
Well, I find him to be confused as to how to succeed in life, and he thinks this is the way.
I think, he's become very successful in life. I think you're confused about the difference between confusion and delusion.
No.
Well, my favourite film about a lonely, isolated pervert is called I'm Adam Richmond. Look at me stroke my penis.
Have you seen The Conversation?
No. What is it again?
This Gene Hackman.
No, I haven't seen it. No.
Yeah, it's such a good film. Yeah. It is the lonely... perv surveillance film.
Oh, it's dead center canon. Is it Plum for the perv? It's Perv Plum.
Because he's not really a perv. He does it because it's his job.
Right.
And it goes very well with Lives of Others.
Right, right. I'll add it to the list.
It's such a good film. Mm. So good. Like a proper pervy one.
Right.
More of a perv is 1 hour photo.
Right.
Which I've forgotten everything about and I'd love to be got on that.
I've never seen it.
Oh Christ! Fine.
I don't like perv movies. You know,
really,
I'm not really much of a perv.
Why not?
Well, I've always thought I'm pretty well adjusted.
What's the perviest film that you saw that you thought, hang on a sec, this isn't for me, pervs?
I remember in the film Happiness. This is not a perv film.
Oh God,
it's not a perv,
that's a perv film.
Maybe
quite
it is.
Pervy.
Yeah, it is a little pervy. I remember
the dad's a fucking pedo.
Yeah. Oh, yeah,
it's number one perv.
I forgot about that. All I remember about it, and I don't even remember who the subject of the photograph, but I recall Philip Seymour Hoffman at the end of the film ejaculating into his hand or onto the back of this photo of someone and then sticking it on his wall.
It's a postcard.
It's a postcard.
I don't think it's even a photo. Right. He just uses it for glue.
Yeah, his cum glue. And that's sort of a pervy moment. And I remember thinking, I don't like this. I don't like this, you know?
What about like Cable Guy?
Cable Guy, never seen it because it's a perv film. Give me some more.
Fucks. How do I Google
perv like, films?
Perv films.
I'd say just be like, straight up and see what you get.
Loner films.
Yeah. Yeah. Films about loners.
What about Lars and the Real Girl?
I have seen that. That's with your man, isn't it? With your man.
Your man. Gozzers.
Gozzers. Don't recall it. Don't think it's a perv film. I think it's just a loner film.
Sorry. I googled loner films, and the top Google return was as a Reddit thread, movies that a loner with no friends can relate to.
Oh, I'm on that as well.
Oh, fuck me. That's so fucking sad. I don't...
Yeah.
I don't,
Station Agent. Gran Torino. Why is Gran Torino in the thread of movies that a loner with no friends can relate to? What, because you're ready to embrace your hate for...
Yeah, never mind. You hate that movie. I just don't think perv is going to come up with anything, and I don't want to Google it.
I'll Google it. Movies about perverts. The most perverted films of all time. What are some good starter sex perverts?
When was the last time you heard from your father?
Daddy.
Movie characters.
That's too it's
with
all sex.
Kinks.
It's all sex based. I don't want.
What's your
like
favourite?
Perv-
What's your.
Because I think, you know, Jimmy Stewart in Rear Window is a bit of a perv. And so that's
right.
What you kind of want, that sweet, sweet.
Yeah, but wasn't every man in an old film a bit of a perv? Like, Lawrence of Arabia was a bit of a perv. You know, it wasn't part of the central part of his character. He was just a man before now.
Yeah, but in Rear Window, Jimmy Stewart's got a camera and he's looking at women in their windows.
Yeah, that's what everyone was doing in the past.
Not in Lawrence of Arabia. It's not 3 hours of him sat on the sand
yeah.
with a telescope spying through a fucking tent.
It's him sat on the back of his camel looking across the desert. And occasionally he sees an oasis, and then he looks, and there's two dunes of sand, and then he just sees tits, you know?
Yeah. Well, you like American Pie. That's a film of pervs.
That is true. That is true. But they're pervs of the sort of communal garden variety, aren't they?
Yeah, your basic.
Your basic pervs. Sleeping Beauty. That's pervy.
We don't need to get...
Shame. That's not pervy. That's just sad.
That's
so
just
sad.
About sex.
We
man.
Should do
that's
that at some point.
Sex.
That's a good film. You've probably forgotten
yeah,
it.
Yeah, get me on it. Get me on it. That was good, that perv.
Adam, I don't know if you mind, but I'd quite like to do a section here now called Joe Recasts the Film is an American version, which wouldn't be as good as the original, but this is what would happen if they did it. It did do it. That's what it's called.
Yeah.
There's six characters here. First, we've got our three mainies, which I'll start with. Hargavar, right? Our main Stasi guy. I guarantee you, they would cast Michael Fassbender in this role. He's got the coldness. He's got the sit still and still look cinematic for a long time. He's got the twitchy little eye and he always looks sad and angry at the same time. And he probably would do quite a good job. Obviously, it would be nothing like the original.
He's sort of done this in The Killer.
Yeah.
Yeah, very on the nose.
Yep.
Keep going.
Yep.
Who next?
Okay, George Draiman, the writer. This is kind of cheating because this person isn't, and again, Fassbender wasn't either, but this person isn't an American, but I think they would cast this person in the American remake. It's Mads Mikkelsen.
Does this have to be East Berlin? Can we, like, you can
no,
do
you can
it.
Update it if you want. North Korea?
Sure. I like Mads. Mads is... The problem with Fassbender is that he's really handsome, possibly, no, he's not more handsome than Mads, but they have quite similar facial
yep.
facial faces.
Yep.
In the original, one's quite round.
Agree.
The Stasi's round face. Can you get a round face? Can you go back
you
and recast Fassbender for a round
I've
face?
I've done this all intentionally because I completely agree with you, but that's not what they would do. And now, and I will prove this point now by telling you that with
can you just admit you're just trying to cover yourself because you wanted to do this game?
I genuinely.
And now you're pretending it's like something they would do.
No,
you're doing.
No, I'm doing it on
behalf
of them.
You came up with the game.
Now you shush up now and listen. Right, I'm proving my point now. Christa Maria Zealand, okay, the girlfriend. She, in a good remake, which still wouldn't be as good, she would be.
I'm going to tell you. Wait. This is the game.
Go on. What?
I'm going to guess who you think.
For fuck's sake. A minute ago, this had to be 5 minutes, and now you found a way to guess.
Just Christa Marie.
Christa Marie, right. But let me set the context for you then, okay? I've got two names here. One person it should be, one person it would be, right? And it doesn't matter about like the levels of attractiveness, etc. They're not related to the first film because Americans would just put hot in, and it's one of the problems with these remakes.
I would say all modern American actresses are hot.
Of course, and the degrees of difference, but mine actually relates to age more than anything.
Oh, Keira Knightley?
No.
Oh, okay. Amy Adams?
No.
Okay, who have you picked?
No, keep guessing. I have two more guesses.
Anne Hathaway?
No, I did think about Anne Hathaway, but I didn't do it, no.
You because Hollywood would de-age her, and so she'd be very young.
Sure, exactly. And that's why the person that they would actually cast in the film is Jennifer Lawrence. That's who they would cast as the East Berlin famous actress, right? The person I think it should be, and again, I don't actually think this because the film would be worse than the original, but would be someone slightly older, who feels more like they've lived a bit more and they've got a bit more wisdom and a bit more about them. I think Julianne Moore would be great in this role.
They're not casting Jennifer Lawrence with Mads Mikkelsen now, not these days.
But maybe 5 years ago they would have done that.
Yeah, so let's go back in time in pretend land.
You get why I've done that, though, because like even though it wouldn't make any sense with that massive age difference, I've done that on purpose because I think that's the kind of thing that American remakes have done in the past. Where they've all the male actors have been kind of upgraded to American male actors, but fine, they're all very attractive, but they're whatever. And then all of the female roles are filled with the most unbelievably attractive people who've ever lived.
Well, that's why I think maybe your Mads Mikkelsen's massively off your game.
Because he's too attractive. Who you want.
No, because he's not buffo big enough.
Oh, mate. Fassbender's the pull here.
The people that you're saying are casting this would not cast Mads Mikkelsen in that role.
I think they would.
They would cast Ryan Gosling in it.
No, he's too. No. The men don't need to be super attractive. That's my point. It's just the women.
George Draiman does. No, George Draiman. Yeah,
but Mads Mikkelsen is incredibly handsome.
Yeah, but he's too old and he's not American.
I don't like how you're reviewing my creativity.
Oh, fuck.
Here.
Sorry.
I think the way that you're dealing with my creativity is very wrong and is closing it down. You're going, no. I haven't prepared anything myself, but I actually think yours is all wrong. Yeah?
It's not all wrong.
Adam.
I'm just confused. I'm totally confused.
Because you keep interrupting me when I'm trying to explain it.
But that's like everyone says, they've all said that's the funnest bits when I do that.
Fuck, Mickey,
carry on.
You've been enhanced. Now, I've got the three side characters. We've got Grubitz, who's a Hargaver's boss. We've got Minister Bruno Hempf, who's the horrible guy who's Grubitz's boss. And then we've got Paul Hauser, who's Draymond's friend, the rebellious journalist, yeah? The rebellious journalist.
Rebellious.
You're going to say Stanley Tucci.
Stanley Tucci is playing one of these characters.
No.
Okay.
I've put Paul Hauser in the rebellious journalist role. I've put Gary Oldman because I think he'd be funny as the really like obvious over long-haired guy who's clearly passing scripts to the West, you know.
Love
That's
it.
Fun.
Yeah,
oh,
yeah,
great.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Love it.
I really
love
liked it when
love
you said
it.
You loved it. Here's one. You will actually like this one. Minister Bruno Hempf is played by David Morse because he's big and he's scary and intimidating and he does creepy really, really well. Plus, he's a safe pair of hands. You know he can do the job.
He's very powerful.
Yeah.
I'd like someone a bit fatter and a bit more... But yeah, Morse. He's almost too intimidating.
Right.
Where there was something quite buffoonish and fat.
You want something pathetic about him as well. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. But more so, there's no pathetic.
No, that's good. That's a good note. That's a good note. Yeah. All right. Well, how about for my final one then? Grubitz, who's Hargaver's boss, played by Walter Goggins. Walton Goggins, I'm sorry. Yes, that's right.
Yeah, yeah, that's nice.
Yeah.
I think these are too smart for the film. For the people you're imagining, you've done smarter.
Right.
Which is my only note.
Well, I've done a three-way Venn diagram of what would be bad, what I would do, and what they would do. And it's sort of, you know, they're kind of in the middle of all, you know, sort of in the middle of those.
Yeah, you've built a giant hedge because you're scared of people thinking you're not creative, and you are.
I also did it at 9:26, and we started recording at 9:30.
Should we do the box office game?
I'd love to do the box office game. I don't know how you go about thinking about this one, though.
Me neither.
Well,
should we
just dive in?
Let's just rattle through it.
Okay, box office game, budget, brackets estimated for the film The Lives of Others, and probably emphasis on the estimated, I really don't know. But it's in dollars, so we're working with dollars.
Okay.
What do you think they spend on a picture like this? Huh?
Not a much on this. Surely not a much.
I think they're spending not a much.
I think it's not a much. I think it's going to be about $3 million.
You're slightly over, but not far off at all. $2 million estimated is what they spent on this movie. Man, look at the bang you can get for your buck. Yeah? No wonder it doesn't look good.
There you go. There's not much sprawl to it, and that's fair enough. And you don't get a huge lot of interiors,
yeah.
But it's good, you know. You get a sense of when and where you are.
Well, I just love that. I think it's one of the... For me, it's one of the best films I've ever seen. At least it's in my top 30, you know? And it costs barely anything. I think that's great.
It's all in the script, mate.
Yeah. Well done to everybody involved. Opening weekend, US and Canada. Now, that's Feb 11th, 2007. You were seeing it in London. Were your American equivalents, were they out there at the cinema, at the theatre, watching this? What do you think?
So that'll be in the run-up. Was that the year it won the Oscar?
Feb 11th, 2007 is... So it did win it. It did win it around then. So some people would have been going to see it.
$50,000.
A little more than that. It made $223,000 in its opening weekend.
Wow.
That's not terrible.
Wow.
In America, for a German
movie.
They
hate Germans.
They hate Germans over there. They're always talking about Germans over there. Now, the final guess. This is very hard, Adam. This is very hard. Gross worldwide for the movie The Lives of Others, $2 million estimated budget, $223,000 opening weekend, US and Canada. Obviously, the gross worldwide figure is including not just US and Canada, and it's runs in total. So, tricky one.
$10 million?
Okay, let me ask you this question then a different way. Give me this in categories, right? So, like, you know, $5 to $10 million, what would that mean? 10 to 20, what would that be? 20 to 50, anything over 50, like how impressive would it be in any of these categories?
I think anything over 10 is phenomenal. Like, if you make your money back.
What about over 50?
I mean, that's just nuts. A film like this making over 50 is
what about over 70?
Is this why no one's ever had to work again who worked on this film?
Because
Florian von Thingy, he's not done... I think he just might have taken all the juice out of his gun if he'd made over 70.
Well, the film made $77,357,476, which
wowzers.
Is a lot of money. It's over 35 times the budget.
Right, should we play the game where one of us reads a list of movies they forgot, to try and catch the other one out and pick our next flick?
Yeah, say and pick our next flick again, though, because you were burping and...
And pick our next flick.
Oh, I'd love to, yes.
I'm going for a sort of... You'll see there's a connection between these films.
Mm-hmm.
If you can guess the connection, you get bonus points.
Oh.
And if guess what? If I don't catch you out, we go to the big list.
The communal list.
Little Miss Sunshine.
I haven't forgotten it. I watched it fairly recently, I would say, maybe within the last 3 or 4 years.
Wow.
As a rewatch, I mean.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. I can't believe he's admitting that.
If you'd got me before that, I think we probably could have done it. And it's maybe one that you might want to sort of keep on the list at some point. I don't want to say perma no, but right now I want to hear the rest on your list because I feel like I'm fairly familiar with that film.
That's something for you to put on your list to get me on.
To get you on, right. Good, yeah, I'll put it on my list. Good.
I forgot it.
Okay, I've put it on there.
Young Adult.
Weirdly, I rewatched that maybe within the last 12 months with my wife. I did not enjoy it anywhere near as much on a rewatch, and it's not because it's not a good film. It's because it's so unpleasant to watch for the reasons of social awkwardness. And like, I watched that film through my hands more than a scary movie. Not more than a scary movie, but a scary movie, and not just one of the franchises. You know what I'm saying? One of the a film that is scary. I watch that through my hands more than I watch a film that is scary. So no.
Okay. That's two for two. Doubt.
With Streepy, I've never seen Doubt.
Oh, you've never seen Doubt with Streep and Adams and Seymour Hoffman.
Yeah, never seen it. It just didn't appeal to me, you know. It seemed very much like a drag.
Yeah, no, it's not too draggy. Not too draggy. Erin Brockovich.
I watched that for the first time about 6 months ago as part of movie club that I do with my friend Paul.
Right.
So I can't knowingly allow that, but I could add it to my list at some point to get you with, perhaps maybe in another 6 months or so, because I don't really want to watch it again that soon.
Do you get what the connection is?
Oh, I forgot there was a connection. Women?
No, well done.
Yes.
Oh, women.
Yes.
Okay, I'm gonna just swing for this. I don't care.
And just to be clear, it's worth saying to the audience who are listening, this is reference to the fact that we've done barely any films with women in the leading roles, as opposed to women simply serving as an obvious connection between films. Yeah.
Yeah, great.
Because in all other films, the connection might be, oh, the theme of loneliness or something really specific. But we're here, we're like, yeah, women, that's the same. You know, it's not that.
No, it's just trying to just look up the films that we've watched that feature women in a key role.
Sure. Yeah.
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 Gravity.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That's... I saw it the once in the cinema. I can't really recall what I made of it.
So feels like partial plum. I'm not entirely happy.
It's not a full plum, but like I definitely can't remember most of what happens between George Clooney dying and her thinking that George Clooney hasn't died. And I think that's because she's on her own the whole time, right? So there's not, you know.
I mean, I don't remember too much about it, but I remember it was big and I... No, people don't really chat about that movie anymore. So it feels like canon forgot you forgot, right?
I agree. It's a good-looking film. That's what everyone said. Oh, it's great-looking. It looks great. Well, good performance because it's a one-person performance. But it didn't tick enough of the boxes to stick around. So partial plum on me, I think partial plum on the public, partial public plum, I think that's enough of a plum to say, yes, let's do Gravity.
Oh, that was the Lives of the Others episode. Das Leben der Anderen. You've been listening to the Movies You Forgot, You Forgot podcast. Thank you so much for joining us. If you've got any movies you want to get on the big communal list, please email us moviesyouforgotyouforgot@gmail.com. Mm-hmm. That's so difficult to say. What a fucking stupid email address. Please do follow me on Letterboxd. It's so much fun over there. I am at Error of Ways. It's lovely fun. I will follow you back. Always. That's my rule. Okay, say bye.
Bye.